There's a big trend in business that you may not be aware of. It is the practice of what's called corporate social responsibility, or CSR.
You have 90% of G250 companies, there's a global Fortune 250 companies, 90% of them are now publishing annual CSR reports.
So you say they're publishing annual CSR reports. Is that am I to infer then that they're actually doing CSR, or they're just publishing reports about it?
Yeah, I can't vouch for what each particular company is doing, but I would say by and large, firms are trying to do the right thing. And I think also some people think that that's a way to enhance the bottom line.
That's our friend John List.
And I'm an economist at the University of Chicago.
So let's just give me a quick basket, I guess, of either activities or declarations that constitute modern CSR.
Absolutely.
In other words, firms do what? What does it include?
I would think about it as, you know, every dollar we earn, we give a nickel to charity, or we use items that aren't produced by child workers. We're trying to make the world a better place, and we're willing to even give up profits to make the world a better place.
Is that really why so many firms practice CSR? Many businesses, large and small, surely are populated by people with good intentions and pure hearts. But you can also imagine some less than pure reasons for a company to embrace CSR. Maybe to make itself more appealing to customers, or to shore up a fragile or damaged reputation. Maybe even to balance out some questionable business practices. One of John List's predecessor economists at the University of Chicago was skeptical about CSR on an almost existential level.
Milton Friedman argued CSR is a fundamentally subversive doctrine and declared that the business of business is business.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, even if the business of business is business, could it be that CSR is also good for business?
Are people more likely to work for a CSR firm, or do they work harder, or do they pay more attention to quality?
We'll hear about a potential downside to all that upstanding behavior.
Doing good can license people to do bad.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
John, why are you, as what I think of as a pretty free-ranging experimental economist, why are you interested in something like corporate social responsibility?
It actually has really interesting roots that take you all the way back to the 19th century in Great Britain, when there was some social unrest around issues like poverty, working conditions, and child labor. And soon after that, businesses responded with what I would call an industrial welfare movement. And it's still hotly debated whether those actions were profit motivated, socially motivated, or both. And as a field experimenter, I like to go out and say, okay, why are people doing what they're doing? And does it make the world a better place?
So List took a look at the existing CSR literature.
When I entered the literature, what I read was essentially a basket of studies that focused on what I would call the demand side, or how CSR affects consumers.
Which means what?
And what I mean by that is how consumers view our product. So people kind of think that this is firms engaging in product differentiation, or perhaps it's kind of a cheap form of marketing.
So how effective is CSR on those dimensions?
By and large, the literature is really mixed, and there are really no real effects on the demand side.
In other words, customers don't seem to care all that much. So if the goal of CSR is to, say, expand market share, it doesn't seem to be working.
So I started to think, well, let's step back and ask the question, if there's no demand side effects, then why are all these firms doing it?
So List came up with some questions about the supply side, meaning the companies that practice CSR and the people who work there.
Yes, so that's kind of where I started my focus. You know, asking questions like, are people more likely to work for a CSR firm, or do they work harder, or do they pay more attention to quality? And when you ask those questions, then you step back and say, well, where are the firms I can partner with to try to explore these questions about the effects of CSR on the supply side? And then it's very difficult to find research partners. So
yeah, let me make sure I understand this. You're saying you have these, what strike me as really interesting and good questions about the effects of CSR. And I guess what you'd want to do then is come into, you know, let's say 10 firms and randomize them and then do a bunch of stuff, but you couldn't get firms to let you do that. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, you have an idea and then you say, well, how are we going to carry this out? I really don't want to do it in the lab because I don't really think that students act like firms, but I want to do it. You can either partner with a firm or you can take matters into your own hands and create your own firm and hire real people and see exactly if people do respond to CSR incentives.
So I'm confused. You actually started a firm to carry out this research?
Absolutely. So our firm is called HHL Solutions. And what that means is I have two co-authors named Daniel Hedblum and Brent Hickman. And that's where the HHL comes from. So we're actually a licensed LLC to provide data collection services.
Nice. And also the bonus of that is you can get the new pass-through income deduction from the new federal tax law. So bonus
there. Absolutely. Something I didn't think about, but of course something you would think about, Stephen.
There you go. Okay, nice. All right. So you've got this new LLC. And what is the product or good or service that you're going to provide?
Yeah. So essentially what we're going to do is we're going to hire people to look at snapshots from Google Street View, and they're going to enter the characteristics of those blocks.
Okay.
So we're going to do this for Uber and do this for Chicago Heights elementary schools as well. So there's actually real clients, and we need to hire real people to get the Google Street View into some text formats. Now, the next step, of course, is, you know, how are you going to hire people and run this as a field experiment? And what we did was we placed online job ads on Craigslist in 12 cities around the states. And to explore exactly what are the effects of CSR, what we did is across those different job ads, we varied the wages from $11 to $15 per hour. And we also varied whether the firm was a CSR firm or not.
And talk to me about how the firm's CSR was communicated and whether there was any variance in that as well.
Exactly. That's key. So our CSR language was as follows. We simply stated in the ads, some of our projects are aimed at improving access to education for underprivileged children. We believe that these organizations are making the world a better place, and we want to help them.
Okay, so what exactly is the research question you're trying to answer now in this hiring experiment?
So the first question is, when we put CSR ads out there, do different types of people respond to those ads? And then secondly, after we hire them, do they work harder on the job when we give them real work for real pay?
The first step in this study was to advertise the jobs without the CSR component, with the sole variable being the hourly wage. This would help List and his colleagues determine the relationship between what the job paid and the demand for the job. Some ads, remember, offered $11 and some offered $15.
And in fact, when you go from $11 to $15, you actually raise application rates by about 33%.
To an economist, this was not surprising. That's exactly how supply and demand are supposed to work.
But now that's important because once you see what the wage effect is, you can compare that effect to the CSR effect.
In other words, List could now offer two jobs with identical wages, with the only variable being that one ad says the company practices CSR.
Some of our projects are aimed at improving access to education for underprivileged children.
While the other ad says nothing about CSR.
And when you compare the application rates to those two different jobs, what you find is the CSR job attracts about 33% more in application rates. So it ends up being about the same as that wage increase.
That's amazing. So, okay, so to be both reductive and cynical, I could say rather than paying someone $15 instead of $11, I can just say I'm a CSR firm and pay them $11, and I'm going to get the same, at least the same volume of recruits, correct?
That's correct. You can use CSR to increase the pool of applicants by roughly the same magnitude as a 27% wage increase.
But then I gather what you really care about in the end is the quality and the characteristics of those employees. Was your firm real enough to measure that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the real gem here is that we also attract a very different type of worker who responds to the CSR ad. People who apply for the CSR firm actually are more productive per hour for us, and they enter more data accurately.
So companies that promote their CSR programs attract better job applicants. What List uncovered here was a mechanism, a very useful mechanism, that allows firms to sort potential employees.
Oh, exactly. The initial job advertisement explaining exactly what kind of job it is, what kind of firm it is an extremely important moment for the organization to send a signal that we are this type of employer. And that is by far the most important card when it comes to attracting and keeping really good workers. It's the sorting stage.
If you were a big firm CEO or head of HR and you could sort along one of just two metrics, one is, let's call it IQ, and number two is, let's say, sensitivity to CSR, corporate social responsibility, which do you sort along?
You know, I think there's a mixture, what economists would call a convex combination, but I would say that if I had to choose one or the other, I would opt for the CSR variant, in part because if a CSR worker believes in the cause that they're working for, they will work day and night.
These workers, it turned out, were 10 to 25% more productive than the average employee. List and his team also looked at the demographics of their employees to see what kind of person was most sensitive to the CSR appeal.
The actual CSR effect itself is primarily driven by women in terms of productivity. So what I mean by that is it's female workers who are selecting into CSR firms. They are much more productive than other workers selecting into other types of firms. So our CSR effect is entirely driven by women.
Is there any reason to think that the type of CSR that your firm was promising, helping kids, may have been the driver in why it was women who seemed to respond more?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that might be part of the explanation. But when you look at the literature, you know, a few decades worth of experiments, what you typically find is that women are much more sensitive to cues around altruism or social pressure or doing the right thing. So I think it is much more than just wording.
It's pretty remarkable if you think about it, and probably goes a long way toward explaining why, as John List told us earlier, so many companies not only practice corporate social responsibility, but promote their practice of it.
90% of G250 companies, this is global Fortune 250 companies, 90% of them are now publishing annual CSR reports.
CSR, it turns out, is a great sorting mechanism to attract not only more potential employees, but a better class of employees who will work harder for less money. What's not to like? Well, John List, being an economist, looks at the world in terms of costs and benefits. Is it really possible for something with so many benefits to have no costs?
Exactly.
So he and some colleagues ran a second experiment with the following question in mind.
So I'm going to ask, can this type of approach actually backfire in some way?
Did you begin with a theory or with the data?
You know, we did begin with an idea that it's possible that this could work. And what I mean by working is that CSR could make people work harder for us, kind of like in our first piece of research. But we also wrote down a theory where there's this more nefarious channel where people will actually use that CSR is a license to do a bad thing.
Coming up after the break, we name this phenomenon.
Yeah, that falls under the terminology of moral licensing.
And we explore real-world examples.
By endorsing Obama, they've credentialed themselves in their eyes as a non-prejudiced individual.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Why do the vast majority of companies who are in the business of making money also put so much emphasis on giving money away and being good corporate citizens? There are probably a lot of reasons. For one, maybe they just are good citizens. We don't have to be cynical about every behavior, do we? But the economist John List, using a field experiment with a real company that he set up, found that CSR, or corporate social responsibility, also attracts more and better employees. But he also wondered if perhaps there's a downside to CSR. To find out, he set up a second experiment.
So what we did here, and this is a field experiment with one of my postdocs, Fatima Momeni, we hired more than 1,500 workers to do a really short-term job for us.
They recruited these workers using Amazon Mechanical Turk, the labor crowdsourcing marketplace.
And it's really sort of a dismal job.
How dismal?
What we have them do is we have them transcribe images. Those images are composed of about 30 words each.
The images came from German books.
So, you know, these are non-German speakers or non-German readers or writers. So we have them sit in their own home and do the job for us.
The ads that recruited these workers said nothing about the employer practicing CSR.
So in essence, I'm trying to shut down the channel of sorting.
The CSR message would come later, once they were hired. And to make the experiment an experiment, the CSR message was randomized between two groups.
So we have two identical pools of workers. One group is told, you are doing this chore, and you're not only going to be paid for it, but we're actually going to donate some of our cash to UNICEF. In another group, they're just told, please do this task, and you're going to be paid for the task.
And were you actually giving real money to that UNICEF project?
Absolutely. Absolutely. All of this work here is without deception, and all the cash is donated
to UNICEF. Just want to make sure, because that would be some irony if, you know, you're trying to see if working for a good guy company makes you do bad stuff, and then you lie about giving the money to UNICEF.
And then I lie about it. Exactly. No, everything's above board.
Each worker was given 10 images of German text they were supposed to translate into English.
Most of them are actually using Google Translate.
If, however, they found an image to be illegible, they could skip it. And, importantly,
regardless of whether the images that they turn in are correct or not, you receive the same payment.
So if workers are getting paid the same whether or not they translate all 10 images, and if the workers are the ones to determine whether an image is legible, well, that presents a fine opportunity to cheat, in essence, to steal from their employers. This is a topic that economists consider quite important.
Yes, when you look at employee theft of either money or goods and services, it is actually enormous. It's in the billions of dollars every year. Employees steal much more money than bank robbers from banks. You know, a lot of times we talk about bank robbers are bad. if you really want to save your money in a bank, you should be watching out for employees, not bank robbers. When you look at data from hospitals, you just have a tremendous, tremendous amount of employee theft out there in our modern economies.
So before you tell us the results, what results were you expecting?
My expectations were really very simple, that CSR is going to work. And when you introduce workers to CSR, they'll work harder for you and they'll cheat much less. That was my straight out expectation, that CSR is going to work in this setting. And then we're going to walk away and say CSR is great.
Mm-hmm. And from the tone of your voice, I gather that's not the story that emerged.
Unfortunately for my firm here and for humanity, that's certainly not what emerged. What emerges is that many more people end up cheating and reporting that these images are unreadable. And in fact, roughly 24% more employees, when they're in CSR, end up doing this fundamental misbehavior in the workplace of saying that the images are unreadable when they really are readable.
And so this cheating is evidence to you of what exactly?
What this cheating suggests is that there's something else going on within the CSR incentive that is much deeper than what my initial inclinations had me believing. My initial inclinations were that firm does a good thing, worker reciprocates to firm by working harder, and the world is a better place. Everyone's better off. But what this suggests is that there's something deeper on the psychological side, that it's not just triggering this reciprocity from workers. CSR is also triggering something deeper, which the researchers in this area call moral licensing.
So people have surprisingly low standards for what counts as a moral license.
That's Daniel Efrin.
I'm an associate professor of organizational behavior here at London Business School.
Efrin's definition of moral licensing is pretty simple.
Doing good can license people to do bad.
And when he says that people have surprisingly low standards, here's what he means.
It's not just actively doing things that feel like good deeds. People feel like they have a license when they reflect on the bad things they could have done but didn't do.
For instance,
so there's a study showing that when people express a hypothetical preference for purchasing environmentally friendly products over conventional products, they're more likely to lie, cheat, and steal in a subsequent laboratory task. So people are torn. On the one hand, we want to feel like reasonably ethical human beings. And on the other hand, we face a lot of temptations that would take us away from our ethical values, or at least temptations to act in ways that could call our morality into question. And so people need to kind of do this dance to balance those competing forces. They act in morally inconsistent ways. Moral licensing is one way that people balance those forces and enable themselves to not always act perfectly virtuously.
Efrin's contribution to the moral licensing literature dates back to 2008.
So I'm a new grad student. I'm talking with a colleague of mine named Jessica Cameron about the election. And we observe that very soon millions of Americans are going to go to the ballot box and express their support for the first African-American presidential candidate nominated by a major party. And we wondered, what's the psychological effect of this going to be? Could there be any ironic consequences?
Efrin knew about a paper written by two of his advisors
called Moral Credentials and the Expression of Prejudice, showing that when people express a non-prejudiced view, they subsequently feel more comfortable expressing other views that could seem prejudiced. And we wondered, could expressing support for Obama have a similar effect? So we ran some studies on the Stanford campus.
Here's how it worked.
We collected data from Stanford undergraduates. All of them were Obama supporters. And half of them, we gave them an opportunity to identify themselves as Obama supporters. And the other half, we gave them no such opportunity. Then we asked them a difficult question. We asked them to imagine that they were the chief of police in a small town where racist attitudes against black people are common. And we said, it's time to hire a new officer. Do you think this job is better suited for a white person, for a black person, or do you think race shouldn't be an issue in this decision?
The question was designed to allow an implicit declaration of prejudice.
So what we found is when people had no opportunity to express their support for Obama, the vast majority of them went with the safe answer. They said, I don't think race should be a factor in this hiring decision at all. But when people had an opportunity to express their support for Obama, they subsequently were more likely to say that they would rather hire a white person than a black person for the job. They were more likely to express this ambiguous view that could seem prejudiced. By endorsing Obama, they've credentialed themselves in their eyes as a non-prejudiced individual, so they can express this ambiguous view without fear of feeling or appearing prejudiced.
So think about charitable giving.
That's John List again with another example of moral licensing.
If you've just given money to a charity, you're now more likely to cheat a bit on your taxes. So in this way, when you think about what the federal government does, they sort of play right into our hands when on our tax forms, they have us list our charitable gifts. Now merely, what the literature suggests is that merely being reminded of a good deed can actually induce you to misbehave on other dimensions.
So if you're rewriting the tax forms, what do you do?
I definitely remove the listing of charitable gifts alongside list your income from other sources. And you have to disconnect these two things if you want to mitigate cheating.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have it come last?
I think I have it come all together in a different set of forms.
Let me ask you this. You know, when you describe moral licensing, it resonates at least with me, but just as easily, the opposite could resonate for me. In other words, if you had told me, you know, when I do a positive or a pro-social behavior, then I kind of give myself permission to do something a little bit antisocial or selfish, right? But I could also
Correct.
Imagine you saying that when I do a pro-social behavior, habit formation being what it is, and there's a ton of psychology on that, it should lead to more. I'm just curious if that strikes you as at all contradictory or potentially contradictory.
I think potentially, absolutely. Do a good deed here, you're more likely to do a good deed tomorrow. Now, the data, by and large, don't suggest that that's true. Now, that's not to say that there aren't good types and bad types. I think we need to differentiate this argument. So one case is you have people who tend to do good things, and you have other people who tend to do bad things. That's certainly true. What this is saying is that let's take a good person and remind them that, you know what? You've just done these three really good behaviors versus taking an identical good person and saying nothing. It's more likely that tomorrow the person who you reminded that they were doing good will actually do something bad versus not reminding them. That's the important thing to recognize what this literature suggests.
So how does John List think, on balance, that companies should think about the effects of their CSR agenda?
It can importantly influence the types of workers who want to come and work for your firm. But there is a bit of caution in saying you need to put up safeguards when you use CSR because there might be this bad guy lurking around the corner who might end up causing CSR not to be as effective as what it otherwise could be.
There's one more potential consequence to all the CSR that firms are practicing, a really big one: political influence. A recent working paper by four economists looked at corporate philanthropy as a form of what they call tax-exempt lobbying. They found that firms increase their charitable donations in congressional districts when those districts' representatives get seats on committees that are relevant to the firm's business. How much money are we talking about here? The economists write, quote, "Our estimates imply that 7.1% of total U.S. corporate charitable giving is politically motivated, an amount that is 280% larger than annual PAC contributions and about 40% of total federal lobbying expenditures." So that's not nothing, and it feels like we should talk about this topic some more. But maybe, rather than from the economist's perspective, it should be from the perspective of the companies themselves. Wouldn't it be nice to hear about corporate social responsibility from a company that takes CSR really seriously?
We think of corporate responsibility very simply as the how of how we do business. From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
If I asked you to guess the least popular business sector in the United States, what would you say? Here's a hint. The very low approval rating of this industry nearly ties it with the federal government. According to Gallup, only about a third of Americans give this industry a positive rating. It is so unpopular that even the very, very unpopular federal government attacks it all the time. Politicians of every leaning, from Rand Paul, the Republican senator from Kentucky,
"Big Pharma manipulates the system to keep prices high,"
to Elizabeth Warren, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts,
"And a lot of that money that is spent lobbying Congress is to keep drug prices high,"
from Donald Trump,
"The drug companies, frankly, are getting away with murder,"
to Bernie Sanders,
"I have been fighting the greed of the prescription drug industry for decades. And as far as I can tell, the pharmaceutical industry always wins."
And here's an interesting twist. The pharmaceutical industry is also the most charitable industry in America. According to a survey by the Chronicle of Philanthropy, the top three American companies for charitable contributions are Pfizer, Gilead Sciences, and Merck. Also in the top 10, Bristol-Myers Squibb and Eli Lilly. It's hard to imagine that being so charitable is what makes them unpopular. Probably makes more sense to think that their charity is meant to mitigate their unpopularity, although it doesn't seem to be working so well. So let's hear from someone who runs corporate social responsibility at one of those firms. Someone at the most charitable firm in America.
My name is Caroline Roan, and I wear two hats for Pfizer. One is vice president of corporate responsibility for the company, and the other is president of the Pfizer Foundation, which is a separate legal entity.
Pfizer, based in New York City, is a huge company with more than 90,000 employees around the world. It sells its products in 125 countries. There are a lot of over-the-counter brands you are probably familiar with, like Advil, ChapStick, Centrum, Dimetapp, Preparation H, and Robitussin. But Pfizer's big moneymaker is prescription drugs.
You've probably heard of Lipitor, Diflucan, which is an antifungal, Prevnar 13, which is a pneumococcal vaccine, Lyrica, which is for pain. Then, of course, we also contributed Viagra, which was for a very serious disease.
The company was founded in 1849 by two German immigrants. It considers corporate social responsibility, or CSR, to be part of its DNA.
And really, the first, I think, significant contribution was unlocking the ability to mass produce penicillin. And it was a wonder drug, but nobody had sort of sorted out the specifics of how you take it to mass production. And Pfizer did that. And at the time of World War II, they actually ran the plant 24 hours a day and partnered with the United States government to ensure that we had enough penicillin that our troops could take it ashore on D-Day.
Pfizer created its foundation in 1953 and their Department of Corporate Responsibility in 2001. That's the same year Roan joined the company. Today, she's in charge of both CSR and the foundation. Pfizer has a wide range of helping initiatives, from medicine giveaways, to R&D addressing diseases common in low-income populations, to a project called Global Health Fellows.
So we call it Pfizer's Peace Corps, if you will, and we will literally donate our colleagues to go work at non-governmental organizations to support the efforts on the ground and in the field. I've literally had people come to the company and tell me, I came to this company because I knew you had this program, and I've waited for my 3 years in to be able to participate.
Caroline, did you have a stint in this Peace Corps type project?
I haven't, but I feel like I do because, you know, I've been to Kakuma, I've been in Kenya, I've been to Lalibela in Ethiopia. I mean, I have gotten to see the little medicine that we produce all the way in Puerto Rico make it to the most remote locations, and it's profound, and it restores your soul on a fundamental level.
So let me ask you this. Why is there a Department of Corporate Responsibility that needs a vice president like yourself? Like, isn't everyone in a corporation responsible somehow?
I think, Stephen, that's a great point. We think of corporate responsibility very simply as the how of how we do business. And it's very much grounded in the mission of the company. That said, in order for us to achieve that mission of discovering and developing these great medicines and vaccines, we have to ensure that we're doing our part to get those medicines and vaccines to the patients who need them.
The economist Milton Friedman famously argued that corporate social responsibility is a, as he called it, a fundamentally subversive doctrine, and that, quote, there is one and only one responsibility of business to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits. So what are the inherent conflicts between profit-seeking and corporate social responsibility?
Well, I'm very familiar with the business of business is business, but we don't make lipstick. We make medicines and vaccines. And so I do think, Stephen, you'll see a vast difference in how industries approach this work. But for Pfizer, you know, in order for us to discover and develop those medicines and vaccines, they have to get to the people that need them. We have to have functioning healthcare systems. And we've got to be more creative and address those needs in a very meaningful way. I mean, we're living in a time of vast income inequality around the world. We know that the poorest of the poor no longer live in the most remote villages. They don't live in low-income countries. They actually live in middle-income countries. They live in urban centers, and governments are failing to provide a very basic set of services. And so what does that mean for a big multinational company that's in the business of health? We've got to adjust and do our part to prove to those patients in those communities that we will help them get access to quality healthcare, medicines, and vaccines. And that's what we do.
So give me an example of where you're having huge success with that, whether it's life expectancy, alleviation of suffering, prevention of death, et cetera, et cetera.
So a perfect example of that is our work in addressing trachoma. It's the number one cause of preventable blindness. And what happens is that you get a repeated infection. And over time, your eyelashes turn inward. It's quite painful, and you go blind. And interestingly, people who came into Ellis Island were checked for trachoma
before, you might remember
seeing pictures of the eyelids being turned.
There was also this terrible story of unintended consequences where they used this tool to check people for it without realizing that it was a bacterial cause and that they were actually spreading it as much as they were alleviating.
Exactly. It's a disease that, you know, of poverty. It's a disease that affects the folks that are living literally at the end of the road. Now, Pfizer discovered that Zithromax, our antibiotic, was effective in treating the active infection that causes this disease. Well, we doubled down on our efforts to eliminate it. We have our eyes on the prize of actually eliminating this disease by the year 2020. So in order to do that, we had to conduct the largest global public health mapping project that has ever occurred. And when we did that, we discovered these pockets of trachoma. And we realized in order to achieve the global elimination goals with the World Health Organization, we were going to have to increase the donation of Zithromax. We were also going to have to support a comprehensive public health strategy. And we are literally changing one community at a time. The ability for young children and moms to avoid this infection and to avoid blindness. It's one of the most powerful programs I've ever seen in the field, and one that I think I'm most proud about.
And I assume you're giving all that medicine away, correct?
Yes. In fact, Stephen, interestingly, half of the production of Pfizer's commercial supply of Zithromax, more than half, is donated to support this program.
Let me back up for just a second, because the industry that you're in is an inherently interesting one. I don't know about inherently controversial, but it is controversial. So your sector is, we know, not so beloved by the general public, which is interesting because you make medicine that helps people. But it is, according to the latest data I've seen, the least popular business sector in America. Worse than the legal field, worse than oil and gas. So why do you think such a firm and the industry is not better regarded?
You know, it's a great point. And I think one that I will confess, we don't have a lot of wind at our back. Those statistics are right. And it's confounding to us. What I wish the public would understand is Pfizer's literally deep and abiding commitment to patients. We put patients first in everything that we do. And we believe if we can deliver for patients, we'll deliver for shareholders and we'll deliver for society. And unfortunately, Stephen, we're in a world where bad actors and headlines grab people, and the complex story of drug development is hard to give you in a soundbite or in a tweet. And we do our best to tell that story of commitment to patients and commitment to science, but it is hard to break through.
So Pfizer is hugely successful. Annual revenues in the neighborhood of $54, $55 billion, with profits around $21 or $2 billion, so a good profit margin. It's smart. It's a strategic firm. But often that strategy isn't what most people would think of as quite kosher. So let me give you a couple examples, then ask you how CSR fits into that. So a couple of years ago, Pfizer was planning on an inversion merger with an Irish firm, but that was spiked by the Treasury Department. It was considered a method of avoiding taxes by merging with a foreign company. Pfizer's also paid the second largest settlement claim ever by a pharmaceutical company, more than $2 billion, for violating the False Claims Act with infractions that included kickbacks on several drugs. So when we, the non-pharma community, learn about that as a company, and we also know how much pharmaceutical firms spend on lobbying and so on, why wouldn't we be wise to be skeptical of something like corporate social responsibility as practiced by Pfizer? Why wouldn't we be wise to see it as little more than a form of PR or some kind of whitewashing?
You know, there is a fair amount of skepticism out there for big business overall. For Pfizer, the reason I believe that people should take another look is that we have four clearly defined strategic priorities. And I think it has set the path for us in terms of responsible business growth. And the first is around our science. We are working every single day to get the necessary resources to innovate to create the next generation of important medicines. Second, we are looking at the allocation of the resources for the long-term results for our shareholders. We would be remiss if we didn't do that. The third and fourth imperative are critically important. We're trying to create a culture where we work as a team, where we win the right way, where we are compliant and consistently delivering the business growth that we want to in the right way. And the fourth imperative is being a responsible corporate citizen. So every single person in this company knows that that's a part of their day job.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about this massive chunk of value that Pfizer gives away as part of its corporate responsibility initiative. In the most recent year for which you've provided the numbers, it's about $5 billion in total giving out of revenues of about $52 billion. So, you know, roughly 10% of revenues are given away. Now, $4.7 billion of that is product donations. And then the cash represents, if I'm calculating correctly, about 0.4%. So if I wanted to be churlish, I would say, well, okay, Pfizer's giving away not very much money, but giving away a lot of in-kind donation in the form of medicine. Let's start with how the value is attached to that medicine that's given away. What is the actual valuation process to attach a number to the drugs that are given away?
So I would say the following. That is complicated, and I am not intimately engaged in the valuation process. Look, one of the reasons we give away a lot of product is our most valuable asset, right? When we think about where we can make the biggest difference, what does Pfizer have that's unique? Well, we have the medicines and the vaccines that we've discovered and developed, and people need them. That's why at any given point, if you were to ask our partners what they're asking us for, they're starting with our medicines and our vaccines, right? And in the U.S., for more than 30 years, we've had a program in place. It's now called Pfizer Rx Pathways. And that's designed to help people who are falling through the cracks get access to medicines here in the United States. We offer more than 70 products to patients free or deeply discounted. Last year, we helped 250,000 people get about 1.7 million prescriptions.
Some people say, well, it's wonderful that you and firms like you give away a lot of your drugs to people in need, people in crisis, people who can't afford it, people who don't have access to it. But rather than that model of let's sell our product in some markets and make as much money as we can, which is what firms do, and then give away some of it in other markets, why not have a pricing structure that, as difficult as it may be to come up with, that makes it affordable for people to buy on a sustained basis everywhere rather than having communities need to rely on charitable donations?
Well, it's a great point, and increasingly we are moving in the direction of what we're calling creative commercial strategies. So we have tiered pricing globally, which means that countries pay based on an ability to afford the medication. But we also, for the poorest of the poor, which is where I focus our efforts, we're looking at strategies that are truly built on public-private partnerships that provide our products at an affordable cost to organizations who are working to serve this population. And a perfect example is our work with Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. The Gates Foundation really started this effort and deserves credit for it. But Gavi makes a whole host of vaccines across companies available to 73 of the poorest countries. And we provide our pneumococcal vaccine, which is one of our most innovative products, at less than $3 a dose. And countries can purchase through the Gavi Alliance if they so choose to and believe it's a more sustainable approach.
And what would that $3 dose cost in the U.S.?
I actually don't know what it would cost in the U.S.
We looked up the price of that pneumococcal vaccine, Prevnar 13, in the United States. The CDC pays Pfizer about $130 per dose. If you buy it privately, it costs about $180. Pricing and other economic maneuvers are at the root of the pharmaceutical industry's poor reputation. For one, the industry often practices what's called value-based pricing. This means setting a price based on what an ailment would cost society if it weren't treated or if it was treated by a less effective medicine. That and exclusive patent rights explains how a 3-month course of a hepatitis C treatment made by Gilead Sciences can cost more than $90,000. Given the pharmaceutical industry's deep unpopularity and their deep profitability, you can see why firms like Pfizer might be so interested in giving away so much of their medicine. I know that there's been some, you might call it, enlightened criticism against the notion of giving away medicine. So one primary argument comes from Doctors Without Borders. They basically said there's no such thing as a free vaccine, that, you know, free is not always better. Sometimes there are strings attached. They've argued that donations can undermine long-term efforts to increase access to affordable vaccines and medicines, that it might destroy the incentive for other firms to produce or to distribute, or that donations, you know, they might come in when you need them, but then it might not be long-lasting. You know, we all know that the world is full of good intentions that lead to outcomes that are less good than we'd like. And I'm curious how you'd respond to those objections to this practice of giving away so much medicine.
Well, you know, it's actually a conversation that's front and center in the global development community, as you well know, just about the role of cash donations, product donations, how we get countries to be self-sufficient. And for Doctors Without Borders specifically, I am very familiar with their concerns. And we've had an open door conversation with them and deeply respect, honestly, their work. And some people do believe that donations are not the answer for how they want to deliver healthcare. And so we've taken steps to address through these more creative commercial partnerships. And a perfect example is our work with Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. But another perfect example is one that we announced last year, providing oncology medicines in Africa. So we looked at the concept of, should we donate these medicines? And the conclusion in conversations with stakeholders and governments was no. They wanted to create a partnership that would allow them to purchase the product. And so in that case, we're offering, together with the American Cancer Society and the Clinton Health Access Initiative, we're expanding access to 11 essential cancer treatment medications that include chemotherapies in mostly East Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Tanzania. On the refugee crisis, so specifically, which was what some of the dialogue with Doctors Without Borders was about, I did want to acknowledge that we did offer to donate our pneumococcal vaccine, and we have donated it to a number of organizations who work in active refugee settings. But we also, hearing that feedback, announced a new humanitarian tier so that the organizations that are conducting that work in refugee settings are allowed to come to Pfizer and purchase our pneumococcal vaccine for, again, the lowest global price, which is under $3 a dose. But for Pfizer, we really debated this. We didn't feel it was appropriate, honestly, to make money in a refugee setting. And we decided for the first year of this program to donate the proceeds back to the organizations who are working on the ground.
Another reason the pharmaceutical industry is so unpopular these days, the opioid crisis. Pfizer is not one of the companies that makes the opioids most commonly abused and is not among the companies being charged with misrepresenting the drug's benefits and concealing their risks. But Pfizer is a big contributor to the drug industry's lobbying arm, which fought hard in the 1990s to allow mass prescription of painkillers, which means that Pfizer is trying to be part of the solution.
So, you know, we always start with our science. So we're accelerating our efforts to bring non-addictive alternative medicines to patients. And we're doing that in partnership with regulatory authorities. We're also working at the community level through primary prevention and education. But I think when we go back to where can Pfizer make the most distinctive difference, in this case, we happen to make naloxone. And you may know that naloxone will reverse an opioid overdose. And we have decided to make that available both through donation and, again, back to the approach of meeting the needs of multiple stakeholders through deeply discounted pricing. So we've committed to more than 1 million doses over 4 years with our partners to make those available free of charge. And then on the commercial side, we've discounted that price significantly for first responders so that no one has to go without naloxone specifically. What's interesting for me in this context, Stephen, is I used to work with heroin addicts when I was at Yale. And so I have a deep appreciation for the pathway of addiction and the challenges that communities face. And so we are really saying that we're ready to be partners in trying to take this on, because we've got to turn it around. I mean, it's a massive problem, and we know that it destroys families, but we think we have a productive role to play in addressing it.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. And if you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.